The White Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for joining me live on what should be an interesting program for you tonight on this Monday, March 25th, 2013. My title is Time to Blow the Holohoax out of the Water. That may seem to be an overambitious statement, but it did occur to me after Saturday's show with Vincent Renoir, and that it is not, and that is what we should be saying. And it occurred to me very strongly and with some clear ideas. So I decided to put the things that I had in mind to talk about, some of the things that I had in mind to talk about, tonight around that theme, and added something else to it. So I think there's a lot of important things going to be expressed tonight, and I think we should not only be saying this, but we should be meaning it. So I'm not just blowing off steam or venting, but I do mean it. And before I get into that, though, and I want to thank you listeners who are here for being with me here. And I'm sure that the number will grow, so that's very good. And the I want to make a few announcements and a few preliminary statements here tonight. The guest hosts for the next 2 weeks I'm going to have guest hosts for the next 2 weeks. I'm going to take some time for myself. It's not that much time, but it gives me a little more time not to have to prepare for this show. And I really need to get some things done, which I cannot get done. You know, when you do 3 programs a week, it kind of takes up most of the time, and you just have a small amount left to do something else, and it's all piling up. So I got this bright idea. I don't know why it took me so long to get this idea, but it finally came to me. Oh, you know, why don't I get somebody to do the whole program? And the first person I thought of was Hadding Scott. And I worked on him first, and he has agreed, and he's going to be doing the program next week on April 1st. And then the following Monday, on April 8th, Andrew Anglin of Total Fascism has agreed to do this show. So I've got 2 guest hosts coming up, and I'm sure you, the listeners, will enjoy that change very much, and it'll be really interesting. I'll sure be interested in listening. It'll be nice to listen to the show for a change with someone else doing it. So this might be something I can think of doing once in a while, which will help me out a lot, and it will work out well for everyone. I want to read a letter, too, that I got this week. You know, the mail is getting very interesting, and I have a lot of good emails coming in, and I thank the people who are sending me these good emails with good information in them. And also, there's seems to be a little uptick in contributions and donations, and I want to thank people for that. I don't have all the names. I know that we got a donation from John. John is in the UK, and he has sent a donation before several times, and he's a real good guy. He's been communicating with me by email probably since I ever started on the White Network, started the Heretics Hour program back on, I'm always having trouble remembering what it is now, the network I was on before. And so he has written a little bit with this one because, and I really appreciate what he said, so I want to read it to you. He said, "The White Network keeps me sane, just about. I've especially enjoyed Tan Stoffel's series on race and blood. His forensic destruction of the tribe's arguments has me cheering as I listen." Yeah, I find myself doing that too, especially lately. "And the international Jew leaves me shaking my head at what might have been had we heeded the warning. As a professional actor, I can testify that the chapters about showbiz are gobsmackingly prophetic and accurate. The same is true of the Rockwell speech. The man was a prophet. I wish I could contribute more." Well, he was generous enough. "But I'm facing very expensive private surgery in the UK. I'll survive, but with a much lighter wallet. And then he says, a cautionary tale. Like all the other working whites here, I've paid a fortune into the NHS via taxes. Now, the National Health Service he's talking about. But it has become a lethal sewer. NHS hospitals would make Mogadishu blush. You can't have a first world health system with a third world population and staff. I can't remember the last time I had a nurse or doctor who was white or spoke comprehensible English. I wish that Michael Moore and the other liberal jackasses who praise socialized medicine had to endure the NHS. In fact, a recent poll revealed that 60% of NHS doctors and nurses would not use their own hospitals. Obamacare, anyone? Well, I thought that was worth reading to you. I thank John not only for his contribution, his check, but for the letter. And I have another email that came to me that I want to read to you. It is from a female named Allie, A-L-L-Y. And she writes, I love your program's network. Keep up the good work. You are an encouragement to us all. I wanted to ask your advice since you might have some good ideas on this. Well, you see, I don't have any good ideas on it, so that's why I'm reading it now to the listeners to see if they will, if they have any good, if you guys have any good ideas, and you'll send them to me so I can pass them on to her. She says, my husband wants to be an activist for whites and use his real name, but as we all know, this may seriously endanger his job. As a young woman who will be starting a hopefully large, she puts in parentheses, family soon, I have a desire for financial security for the sake of my children. I will be staying home with the children, so my working is not an option. We want to find a job where retraining is easy, not something difficult like computer programming. I guess that's too difficult, okay? And where he can't be refused pay, and then in parentheses, like a bounty hunter. I'm not sure I understand that, but I guess if you're a bounty hunter, they can refuse to pay you. And there's, well, I don't know what you where you can't be refused pay, but maybe you all do. She says, do you have any suggestions? What kind of job can an activist hold that is relatively secure? What do the activists who you know do for a living? And she says, thanks. Signs her name. Well, you know, the activists I know don't use their, well, they either don't need a, they don't have a job or they don't use their real name. Now, if they, people who use their real name that I know mostly are not working at the time. So this is difficult, and I don't know if there's an answer, but I'm reading this because I feel like you deserve an answer, Allie, and I'm reading this on the show so that we'll see if anybody has any ideas or has any advice to give you. Maybe your husband just shouldn't, use his real name, but we'll see. We'll see what comes from that. That right before the show started, and I have a lot of material to cover, but I just looked at an email account and I saw this story that just was just posted from France, titled French Far Left Leader Accused of Anti-Semitism. And I thought it was really hilarious in a way. It just came over the wires, I guess. And it reads, reactions to comments made by the leader of France's far left party ignited a weekend of accusations of anti-Semitism and counter-accusations that the ruling socialists were clutching at straws in their attempts to demonize him. I guess demonize this far-left leader, the communist. And it says, the leader of France's far-left party was accused Saturday of making anti-Semitic remarks about the country's finance minister, who was born to Jewish parents, prompting politicians of all stripes to weigh in on an ongoing and increasingly bitter spat played out in the country's media. Jean-Luc Mélenchon, who is in a photo there, who heads the communist allied Parti de Gauche, the left party, referred to French finance minister Pierre Moscovici as one of those 17 Euro group bastards in parentheses, finance ministers, putting pressure on Cyprus as it urgently sought a bailout solution to its debt crisis. And then in quotes, Moscovici behaves like someone who has stopped thinking in French, like someone who thinks only in the language of international finance, Mélenchon told a press conference on Saturday. But rather than criticizing Mélenchon for calling Moscovici a bastard, the comments were slammed by the ruling socialists, for whom language of international finance was for them too reminiscent of anti-Semitic pre-war rhetoric in France. So I that's not all of it. There's more of it, but I think it's quite funny that they're having this battle about anti-Semitism over there amongst the left, the people on the far left between the socialists and the communists, the left and the farther left, and that they don't care that he called him a bastard, but they care that he called him, said he thinks in the language of international finance. So that's what the Jews jump on. And this is very pertinent to what I'm going to say on going on here. You know, this is what they jump on. Anything that is going to smack of characterizing Jews in a certain way, like being, you know, the financial elite of the world and so on, which is absolutely true, but that's why they don't want people to talk about it or say anything about it. So, you know, what I want to talk about tonight is about how tough we should be and how much of a fight we need to be putting up, and how we're not doing that for the most part. There are a few people, but most people are not doing that and not even trying to do it. Now, tonight's program is mostly, I guess you'd say, about Holocaust revisionism. Certainly, basically it is. Or historical revisionism, but a lot of Holocaust revisionism. So this is, what I have in mind when I speak, when I'm saying these things. And so I'll start out by saying, you know, what holds the hoax in place? And we know that it's a holo hoax. We know it's, I don't like using the word Holocaust over and over again, because, you know, it reaffirms that there was such a thing. Some people are shocked for someone to be on a program like this and use the word holo hoax. Although I think it's the right thing to do, so I'm doing it, because this is part of where we have to come out real plain and speak in plain language about this, and not hold back. So anyway, what holds it in place? Not the truth. It's not the truth. It's not about the facts. To figure that out, just look at it this way. Imagine that it was that the Holocaust or holo hoax was actually was blown out of the water. How much else would also go? How many jobs would be lost? How many books would need to be rewritten or trashed altogether? How much embarrassment among how many educated people would exist in, amongst these people who were believing in it and so on? And the fact is that this one element of what's called the Holocaust, the Jewish deportation and the concentration and labor camp system, remains true. So we're not trying to get rid of that. We're not trying to get rid of anything that actually happened. And along with that, along with the concentration camp stories, is stories about SS brutality that go right along with it, and they're hard to get rid of. You know, people are very attached to that. As soon as you bring up one, you imagine you're entertaining the other. So, you know, we have this thing where people love the good guys over the bad guys idea. So this idea that we're going to have some people are the good guys and other people are the bad guys, is very much ingrained. And among all this, though, the idea of deporting Jews, which brings up anti-Semitism, is really the stumbling block in my mind. Of all of this business about the Holocaust and all that can be shown not to be true, we're left with the deportation of Jews, and this is something that people, this is something that in itself people object to because that, you know, well, why do they object to it? Well, it comes down to the Jewish question or the Jewish problem. And again, you know, going to Henry Ford, the book, one of the early titles of that his book was put into, or his series of articles, was, excuse me, The International Jew - The World's Foremost Problem. And it was changed, some were changed later to just The World's Problem. But at one time it was The World's Foremost Problem. So this was recognized then by Henry Ford and his group, and many other people, that the Jewish problem is the world's foremost problem. And that the international Jew, I want to explain, to me, does not mean the finance bankers that we were discussing, you know, that came up in that French article that's in this argument over in France now. I'm so glad. It does mean those people, but also the international Jew, I think, is just the Jew. All Jews are international. You know, all Jews are international. Jews have been moving around, let's say, outside of whatever kind of boundaries they lived in for a couple of centuries. And, of course, I don't believe that the Jews go back 6,000 years. They don't, but, that's another issue. But they, for as long as they've been, you know, the kind of group that they are today, basically, they have, wanted to move outside of their homeland, you might say, whatever that might have been, and go to foreign places or go to places where they could trade. And they are always big traders, and they wanted to go out here, there, and everywhere where they'd find these other people, foreign people, not people like themselves, and trade. So they've always been an internationally oriented people, I would say, you know, basically. And they got more and more that way. In fact, this Alliance Israelite Universelle was the in the 1700s was one of the first time that it was organized, so that you'd have an organization that would be there worldwide. They wanted people, Jews all over the world, to join, or at least all over where Jews were, to join in order to defend Jewish interests wherever they came, wherever they were attacked, or wherever they were question, wherever they had, you know, difficulty. So they've always been international, and this is a part of the reason that they're such a problem. Now, therefore, I think I always want to say Holohawks, I don't know why I can't say Holohoax, survives and will survive in some form as long as the Jewish problem survives. So this brings in a difficulty here, a real difficulty, that how do we defeat the false Holocaust story if we don't get rid of the Jewish problem? Okay, and so the stupendous effort, the Jews know this, the stupendous effort of the Jews throughout history is to prevent their expulsion, because they know that they are a problem and that people want to get rid of them. So this deportation by the Germans was nothing strange. It was nothing so much out of the ordinary, though they want to make it into that. But anyway, their effort is basically to prevent their being expelled from these other countries that they live in. If we think about it, you know, as parasites, and they, you know, we call them that, and a lot of people are offended by that, but they truly are. They truly are, because it's crucial to their survival that they be in other people's countries and live off in some way, the way that they live off the wealth and the strength and the ability and so on of these other people. So a parasite is an accurate word for them. And we have, one of the things we have to do is to stop pulling back from vocabulary like this. There are a lot of people who just go right at it and love it. And then there's all the people who think it's way too much and there's a big rift between these people. Maybe we could find something a little more in between, but I don't think we should back off from telling the truth about it and explaining why it is the truth. So, and so what the Jews do is to create organizations and so on so that, that's not what I wanted to say here. What I wanted to say here was that, everything, you know, that in nature, human beings and nature and so on is built so that survival is the strongest, most primary instinct or value. And so if the Jews think that, their parasitic way of life is necessary to their survival, that's the strongest, most primary, instinct that they have. And they will fight for that strongest, and they do fight for it. We have that too, but we've kind of lost sight of ours because we have not believed that our survival is at stake, up until now. And a lot of people still don't quite get that. You know, they don't get that survival business, but the Jews know it. The Jews have it very, very clear. Now, going to revisionists who love the good Jew, I've always admired revisionists. I love revisionists. I know quite a few revisionists, and I hate to speak badly about them. I hate to criticize them because they're doing a very, very difficult job. But, Vincent Renoir is one of the best that I know. There's a lot who do very good work. It's not just that part of it. It's the strength and courage that he has, and that he continues to work in the face of all the persecution. Yes, some have gone to prison for longer terms, but they didn't intend to. It just happened to them. That hasn't happened to Vincent because in France, I don't think they do quite what they do in what the Germans do, and with the help of other nations. But so, while revisionists do have a difficult job, and there are some of them now who have been in prison and they can't, there's a lot of things they can't do, or they'll be brought back to court and put back in prison possibly. So they really do have to be careful, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about them, you know, protecting themselves. I'm talking about revisionists, and there's a lot of them who love the good Jew, or like the good Jew, or want to like the good Jew, who don't want to be someone who, you know, tars a whole race because of some of the people. That's how they think about it. And they're friends with Jews, and they're tolerant of Jews. They're too tolerant of Jews. They make excuses, and they want to give Jews as much as they can possibly give them in the way of understanding and so on. And basically, even to just accept Jews into our society, is in a way nullifying the work that they're doing because of this survival thing and this parasitism thing. You know, you can't have it both ways. You can't accept the Jews and be friends with the Jews and still keep the Jews from doing this harm to you and living off you in ways that are very negative to the rest of us. And, you know, we've seen the results of this, and it's gotten to the extreme today. The results of all this is extremely damaging to us and extremely harmful. So, you know, to my mind, we're at war, and we need to see that we are at war. And if people can't understand that we're at war, and when you're at war, you're not trying to be friendly with your enemy anymore. It's already, that didn't work, you know? And so you're not doing that. But these people are still trying to do it. But it doesn't work. It can't work. So the deportation of Jews must be reexamined as to whether it was justified or not justified. As we get talking about the Holocaust again, because if you get people to listen to the facts about the gas chambers and what a lot of the numbers and so on, and the whether it was intentional or not, and all of this, you're still left with this wanting to get Jews, the National Socialist government wanting to get Jews out of their country. And there are a lot of people who are okay with this, but they're still, I'm talking still about a lot of revisionists who are not. And they think that we can all live together and we can all get along and we'll just, let's just talk to each other. Let's just reason with one another. You know, oh, I found a few reasonable ones and they're listening to what I have to say. But they don't go all the way. None of them ever do. They never go all the way with our interests being, being looked after fully. They never do that. So this is why, the Jews resort to the criminalization of anti-Semitism, which is hate laws. You know, anti-Semitism is seen as hate. And so you have hate laws. And it's such a huge project of international Jewry. It's been a project of theirs for a long, long time. I already brought up the Alliance Israelite Universelle, which was organized back in the 1700s, in France, but it was connected with worldwide Jewish interests. And right now, the International Jew Program, we're reading about the alert activity of the American Jewish Committee that began in 1906 in the United States. So in 1906, and the Jews were coming heavily around the 1900 period, and immediately they set up this American Jewish Committee in the U.S. to look after their interests. And then later was added the American Jewish Congress and the World Jewish Congress, and scads of other organizations that have branches in every city in the country. And it's all for the protection of Jews. And why do they need protection? Because they know what they are and they know what they're doing. They know what they want from us. So they know they need protection. They pretend it's for physical protection. They pretend that anti-Semitism leads to physical violence against Jews, but it is, what they really want to do, because they know it doesn't lead to physical violence against Jews much. A lot of that they create themselves. So the anti-Semitism, the desire to not allow anti-Semitism is more to stop anti-Jewish thinking, feeling, and believing. They don't want to allow any anti-Jewish thinking to get a hold if they can help it. And that's what they're constantly working at. So the Holocaust is just part of this that they think underlines their need to be able to enforce anti-Semitism and to get governments to help them and to get all this help. But the biggest problem, the real problem for them when you get down to it, is anti-Jewish feeling. And they know they arouse that feeling. And this has all been talked about before, so it's nothing new to most of you. But when we want to talk about facts, they will only respond with anti-Semitism. See, that's why... that's their weapon. And therefore, and I don't really want to be trashing any group or anything, but I'm going to say that CODO, Committee for Open Debate on the Holocaust, is a committee for debate that really, in my opinion, has become useless unless it gears itself up in a different way and becomes much more aggressive. But it doesn't, it's not wanting to do that. It doesn't want to do that because it fits the personality pattern perfectly that I mentioned earlier, that it wants to be looked upon as harmless, and we just want to talk with you. Let's reason this out together. Let's get along. As you know, it's not, it refuses to, does not want to have a veneer or a reputation for being anti-Jewish, period. And I'm just saying here tonight that we're in a war, and we can't pretend that we're not. So we can't pretend that we're looking for debate when there's no debate, and there never has been, because they've never been willing to debate, have they? So it's only power that counts. Who has the power? Jews have been establishing their power for centuries, while they outwardly claim they only seek fairness and equality for themselves. They claim that they're looking for emancipation, they're looking for opportunity, they just want what's fair, they want to be seen as equal citizens, but they're not. That's not really true, because they want to go way beyond that, and they have gone way beyond that, and they seek power because they're always fearful of being expelled, of being, you know, of the people deciding we don't want these Jews around anymore because of what they're doing, and they don't want to give up what they're doing because that's their whole way of life. They really can't change. I would say that's pretty genetic, because it's been in them for so long. Whether they started out that way, I don't know, but I don't care. All I care about is what we have now, and that it's been that way for so long that you have to assume that it's not going to go away. And through reasoning with them, they're not going to change. And a few Jews amongst several million who maybe don't think that way and don't want to be that way is not going to change it either. So therefore, waking up involves more than what people often think it is. It's not just waking up to the facts. It's not just waking up to the reality of Jewish power. But if we're dealing with the Holocaust, it's not just waking up. It's not just learning the facts about what really happened in the Holo-hoax. But it is understanding what I just said about Jewish parasitism and their need to establish power, which really knows no bounds, because they always want more, because they have this feeling of insecurity. So this is where I'm going to go now into start. I'm going to start out with the last one I mentioned on my announcement. That's Charles Kraft update. And then I'm going to go in order back through that Eisenhower, and then on to, my favorite guy, Ken Walzer, and a few other people. So I don't know if I need to quote this. I think I will. I just read this today on at scrapbookpages.com, not on the blog, but on the regular website, because I was looking something up. And I thought this was pretty good and very explanatory about the Holo-hoax and why it's a Holo-hoax. But it's just another one of these factual things that isn't going to change anything. But on April 8th, 1945, around 25 to 30,000 prisoners had arrived at Bergen-Belsen from other concentration camps in the Neuengamme area. On that date, there were over 60,000 prisoners in the camp, and some had to be housed in the barracks of the adjacent Army Training Center. The Geneva Convention specified that civilian prisoners were to be evacuated from a war zone, and up until this time, the Nazi concentration camps had been either evacuated or abandoned as the war progressed. So, following the Geneva Convention, you could not leave your prisoners in a war zone. So as the war was closing in, the front was closing in both on the east and on the west, they thought, to move these prisoners that they had in these camps, and they kept coming in toward the center. So this is what was going on. Therefore, it was totally overcrowded, and then the infrastructure was being bombed. So This led to a typhus epidemic, and it was impossible to evacuate the prisoners from Bergen-Belsen, which was overcrowded because they had typhus, and the camp could not be abandoned for fear that this epidemic would spread to the soldiers of both sides. And this was a very valid fear, and this was all very valid, but you never hear things like this. You never hear all the reasons why things were done the way they were done. And this is just one little example that I thought I would read because it impressed me. Now, Charles Kraft update. You know, I did ask Charles to come on even for a little while tonight, but I think he was out of town. Just, I didn't hear from him. But he did send me a couple of items, which I'm glad of. And it's okay if he's not here because I've got a lot of, I need to move through this. So, but it's just so interesting. These last two, you know, Charles, we were saying how we wanted Charles to get on more radio shows and more programs. And now he's the subject of a program on Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, I guess it is, CBC, their Radio's Day 6 program. Kind of a short program, but about the same length as maybe 10 minutes or so. And then he was also written up in the New Yorker. So, of course, the New Yorker is junk. But anyway, it's got a big, big reputation, and it certainly is mainstream. So I'm going to start with the radio update. What happened here was the host of this little program is named Brent Bambury, and he spoke, not with Charles, but with a Jewish artist, Alan Schechner, who lives in the UK, and he speaks with a British accent. And he has, he does a certain amount of Holocaust artwork himself. He is the one who used pictures of prisoners behind the barbed wire or whatever, and then stuck himself, you know, manipulated the photograph and stuck himself into the picture. And in this one that they mention here, he's holding a can of Diet Coke. And he's in there, he's, you know, there, probably dressed in his own regular clothes amongst these prisoners. And this is supposed to be some kind of a statement, about it all. So the host, though, did use, in the very beginning, use the word sinister to question Kraft's art. And I was really paying attention to these adjectives that they use. There weren't too many in this one, quite a lot in the New Yorker article. But Brent commented to this Jewish artist, Alan Schechner, the meaning of the art changes because of his changed views. So again, they're really getting into this. How are we supposed to deal with this art of his? You know, they don't know what to do. And they're always talking about how it changes. We've discussed this quite a bit on this program, how they see that the meaning changes once you know that Charles Kraft holds views that you didn't think he held before. And Schechner says, so whether the Holocaust happened or whether it happened to the degree it said, oh, I thought that was interesting because he thinks it's was just the bad, the thing that, what's bad about Charles is that he questions, this is, I forgot to put the word question in here, but that he should question whether the Holocaust happened or whether it happened to the degree it said. So that, you know, even if you question whether it happened to the degree it said, that is like, you know, nuts to these guys, especially to the Schechter. I mean, you just don't do that. I mean, it doesn't make sense to him. And then he tells us that he spent a year in a kibbutz in Israel, but he did learn there that the Holocaust was used to justify war against the Palestinians. So, he did say that. He has some kind of a, you know, desire to make people think, but he doesn't go very far with it. And he says that, they ask, how can you handle the Holocaust in art? And he says, well, you have to handle it in a way that's moral, ethical, that you can stand up in front of everybody afterwards, you know, after you've done your artwork, and you can still stand up in front of people and not be ashamed or maybe not have them throw rotten tomatoes at you. But what people does he mean? Is he talking about survivors along with believers, though, probably? Because people, supposedly, they go along with this thing that, this is so offensive to people, not just survivors, but it's so offensive to everybody. Oh, they're so hurt when they see something like what Charles Kraft has made. Well, it's really over the top. And then this Brett, the host, says German mentions the Theodor Adorno, the Jew philosopher who wrote a lot of things. And he's the one who said to write poetry after the Holocaust is barbaric. And he asked him about that quote. But he called him a German philosopher. You know, this Jew who comes from Germany. He was probably even born there. But anyway, that's just the way they do that. He doesn't even call him a German Jewish philosopher. I know he's Jewish, but he just called him a German philosopher. So here we have a program in which these two guys are discussing this about Charles Art and Holocaust and so on. And it's Jews. I think the other guy's a Jew too. But anyway, you know, it's only Jews that get to speak about this. Instead of asking Charles, they ask this other Jewish artist. Maybe they've heard all they want. They did give a couple of comments from Charles on tape. Anyway, let's go to the New Yorker because it's very interesting. It's a title, and it was just, I had that there. It was just a couple days ago. It's not there now. It's March. I think it was, no, here it is, March 24th. This was in March 24th in a column, regular column called Culture Desk in the New Yorker, and an article titled The Conundrum of Nazi Art by Rachel Ahrens. Now, A-R-O-N-S. You know she's a Jewess, Rachel Ahrens. So naturally, they get a Jewess to write about the conundrum of Nazi art. What the heck? What do you think they're going to say? I mean, this is how they do it. Of course, the New Yorker is probably mostly Jewish by now. You know, I haven't read it for a long time. But anyway, so I would say, you know, this, I was surprised. I wasn't surprised. I recognized that this was a very well-written article. And it covers everything about Kraft accurately. It's quite professional. You know, like a lot of these things that have been done are not that professional. But this is professionally done because it goes into, at one place or another, goes into all of Charles' background and everything he's done. And it seems quite accurate to me. But there's all these interesting things in it, like some interesting sentences. And here's some. In the past, many art collectors and curators had interpreted this work as a critique of bigoted and totalitarian ideologies. So see how she gets that in there? In the past, they had interpreted his work as being critical of these bigoted and totalitarian ideologies. And now the revelation about Kraft's repugnant personal opinions have cast his work in a new light and brought up knotty questions about how an artist's intent should influence our evaluation of his work. Now, I think that's interesting. Of course, the word repugnant is what she puts in there. How would you know, his personal opinions are repugnant, but theirs are not. We'll get into that. Now, then, though, she uses this our, and other places she uses we and so on, in which she includes, like, you know, everybody who's not one of these bigoted and totalitarian people, you know, like how our evaluation of his work how his intent should influence that. But it's like there's this big we out there, this big us that she includes herself and everybody, I suppose, decent in. And it's like they're all going to have the same evaluation of his work, and we need to find out what that evaluation should be. See, it's like we need to work this out and come up with what we should think, what we should think about his work as a group, not what a person can think, not that a person can look at it and come to their own conclusion. No, it has to be a big we. And then she writes, in another sentence, precedence for heinous personal beliefs. So, you know, she's calling his personal beliefs heinous. And then says, coinciding with creative brilliance, means she's talking about other brilliant people who had heinous personal beliefs, and uses Ezra Pound and Richard Wagner as examples. And then says, and bigotry embodied in works of great formal achievement, and in parentheses, The Birth of a Nation. That film was bigoted, I guess. And Triumph of the Will, she includes. Now, as a bigoted, a great formal achievement, but bigoted. Now, where is the bigotry in Triumph of the Will? I thought about it, and I don't recall any bigotry in it. I don't, if it just using Nazi symbology and showing the Germans as under National Socialism and all of that, the way they did their things then, that I guess they see as bigotry, even though there's no bigotry in it. There isn't. But the article points out this idea that Kraft has been criticized for duping the art world and fooling thousands, including museums and collectors, and also brings up this article that was in The Weaklings and republished at Salon, which is pretty well known, although it's all internet online, under the headline, We Let Charles Kraft Fool Us. I brought this up once before, and which is quite a goofy title, and asked the question, if Charles Kraft is capable of fooling thousands into thinking him a forward-thinking genius, who else are we currently paying or worshiping to fill us with surreptitious hatred? So there again, they're referring back to Charles Kraft. This is in this Weaklings, the person who wrote this, and it was published at Salon. They're referring back to him is that his work fills people or can fill people with surreptitious hatred. Surreptitious meaning kind of hidden or, you know, sneaky. It's just, you know, on the one hand, this article is well done. On the other, all this stuff is stuck in there, which is very insulting to Charles or to anybody who thinks like him. But she admits that she doesn't go along with this because she says he's posted links to Holocaust denial articles and other anti-Semitic conspiracy theories on Facebook. And then they say where he has over 2,000 friends on Facebook, if he still has them. And then they say, and he has appeared multiple times on white nationalist podcasts like the White Network. And then they put in parentheses, whose about page reads, quote, we recognize that different races and ethnic groups cannot live together in peace on the same soil. And, quote, we do not hesitate to identify and criticize Jews and will not allow them to hide amongst us. Well, you know, we think this is great. We here at the White Network, we think it's great we're getting these mentions and that they keep quoting our mission statement. Because I think that when a lot of people who would read this would not see anything so hateful in it or so wrong in it to say that different groups don't live together in peace, because we see we don't live together in peace. They keep trying to tell us we do. And also gets across the idea that Jews are trying to hide amongst us, that they do hide amongst us. It might wake up a person or two, but they feel it necessary to add that to, now this is the second time we've been in mainstream media here. We, the New York Daily News, which truthfully is considered a tabloid, but it's, you know, it's highly read and, a lot by Jews. But it mentioned us in bold words, and it said about the same thing. It quoted about the same stuff. Notice that they will say the White Network. They will not give any kind of link to it, and they never mention my name. And they don't mention the name of the program. They won't say, you know, the Heretics Hour, or they won't say Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn or Carolyn. They never mention my name. They don't want us to, you know, don't want me to get any publicity, but they will I'm just glad they do say the white network, and they do quote this. So this is just great. And we thank Charles for that. Charles has done that for us, and we're grateful for that. Now, another thing that in an exhibition, Charles told this writer that he listed as his heroes on some questionnaire that they sent him the famous Holocaust deniers Paul Racinier and Sylvia Stoltz. And they write, in France, as in a number of other European countries, Holocaust denial is a crime. So I thought that was just great, that was something Charles would do. They ask him who his heroes would be on this questionnaire, and he puts these Holocaust deniers down. And that got him in trouble with that exhibition. And I got to hurry up here, as usual. According to people knowledgeable about Kraft and his art, his intentions have always been somewhat ambiguous and his work difficult to classify, she says. There isn't a clear line between irony and homage in Kraft's work. And it's a mistake to assume, as many have done in the art world, that an ironic artistic appropriation of Nazi symbols safely amounts to an anti-Nazi critique. So she is saying that just because you use Nazi symbols in an ironic way or some kind of way, it doesn't mean that you're criticizing Nazis. And now they've discovered that they don't think that Kraft was ever criticizing them. And she uses the word moral murkiness surrounding the artistic reproductions of Nazi imagery. And that, you know, again, here's the Jewish element. They always talk about what's Jewish. In 2002, the Jewish Museum in New York held an exhibit called Mirroring Evil, Nazi Imagery, Recent Art. And it featured, among others, the work of this Polish artist I mentioned before who used Lego blocks, that kids' toy thing, to make models of concentration camp buildings and so on and scenes that were, you know, really, really accurate to what the real thing was. And they say that that most of the artists that were featured in this show were Jewish at the Jewish Museum. And their work attempted to confront the horror of the Holocaust, not to negate or dispute it. So it's okay if you confront it in that way. But it's not okay if you're just looking at it with interest and using symbols. So, there was a foreword written by the director of the Institute for Holocaust, Genocide, and Memory Studies for this show at the Jewish Museum. And he said, "We have every right to ask whether such obsession with these media-generated images is aesthetically appropriate." So there again, you have this idea that the art world has to make some decision altogether, whether, you know, what their response to this kind of art should be. Is it appropriate or is it not appropriate? If it's not appropriate, well, then we have to, you know, do something about it, or could it possibly be appropriate? And then he uses the term exploit the repugnant power of Nazi imagery. So there again, you know, if you're all Nazi imagery is repugnant, which is, it's loved by millions of people. People are inspired by it. It's, you know, it's wonderful imagery, but of course they have to see it. They have to keep using these words. But, then they bring up how, and this is something that we've kind of forgotten, but it's really funny. Kraft, she says that Kraft has produced some lesser known or unknown artwork with a direct relationship to his Holocaust denial. In 2008, think of how long ago that was. 2008, he made a miniature diorama of a dwarf family in Auschwitz for the John Erickson Museum of Art. The museum didn't exhibit the piece because Kraft had an accompanying artist statement with it that they didn't like. And he said in his artist statement about this, you know, there were supposed to be dwarfs at, there's this famous dwarf family that was at Auschwitz. There's pictures of them. So Charles made this miniature diorama of these people. Miniature, remember, because they're dwarfs. It's, you know, kind of funny. But he wrote in his he wrote in his statement, denial or trivialization of the received history of the 60-year-old set of events has been declared a criminal act by 9 European governments and the United Nations. The idea of the Holocaust as the single episode of the 20th century, whose consequentiality seems only to increase as it recedes into the past, raises questions about a scale in relation to the proper commemoration of an incident of such psychic magnitude. These issues are what the sensationalized theme and reduced size of this exhibition are attempting to address. That is, reduced size. That is, you know, what is the proper commemoration of this thing, which he thinks the its importance has increased rather than decreased as time goes on, and he questions that. And then he did that Faulschwitz, a metal sculpture of a birdhouse built to look like Auschwitz, and very well done, very funny, I really like it. And he said that this was inspired by his interest in revisionism. And this writer, Aaron, says the name alone belittles the death camps. And again, you know, she should put death camps in quotes, or precede that phrase by so-called death camps. But she doesn't know that. She thinks, you know, that when they say death camps, that's what they actually are. And then she says that pieces like this, the dwarf diorama and the birdhouse, should be ignored. They're morally repugnant and narrowly didactic. But more than that, that Kraft's work still needs to be examined, his other work. And even though we're disgusted by his beliefs, she says it should be difficult to look at art about Nazis, so we should be looking at Kraft's art. We shouldn't look away. And this is probably the best that you're going to get from someone like that. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I have to go to the break now. And when we get back, I'll be talking about Dwight Eisenhower. See you then.
Sie liegen im Westen und Osten, sie liegen in aller Welt, und ihre Helme verrosten, und Kreuz und Hügel zerfällt. Sie liegen verscharrt und versunken, im Massengrab und im Meer, aber es leben Halunken, und die ziehen noch über sie her. Heute tobt mit frechem Gebaren man durch Blätter und Lüge und Glanz. Sie fielen mit 18 Jahren in einem anderen Tanz. Heute tobt mit frechem Gebaren man durch Blätter und Lüge und Glanz. Sie fielen mit 18 Jahren in einem anderen Tanz. Sie waren nicht ausgezogen um Beute und schnöden Gewinn. Was heute verlacht und verlogen, es hatte für sie einen Sinn. Sie hatten ihr junges Leben nicht weniger lieb als die. Heute Höhnen es hinzugeben, sei reine Idiotie. Heute macht man mit funkelnden Wagen und Dünkel und Mammon starrt. Sie starben an vielen Tagen noch hinterm Stacheldraht. Heute macht man mit funkelnden Wagen und Dünkel und Mammon starrt. Sie starben an vielen Tagen noch hinterm Stacheldraht. Thank you. demonstrieren, mehr Freizeit bei höherem Lohn. Sie mussten ins Feld marschieren, der Vater, der Bruder, der Sohn. Sie gingen die Heimat zu schützen und haben allen entsagt, was kann uns der Einsatz nützen, hat keiner von ihnen gefragt. Sie haben ihr Leben und Sterben dem Vaterland geweiht und wussten nicht, welchen Herben und welche Erbärmlichkeit. Sie haben ihr Leben und Sterben dem Vaterland geweiht und wussten nicht, welchen Herben und welche Erbärmlichkeit. Und welche Erbärmlichkeit!
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, and this is Carolyn Yeager on the Heretics Hour. On March 25th, isn't it? March 25th, 2013. And talking about how we can blow the Holocaust out of the water. And the reason I spent so much time talking about these two new pieces print journalism radio journalism, excuse me, that have appeared. About Charles' work and the big deal about him is that I think it spells out very well that we should be going aggressively against these people and these things. We should not. I think I already said this, but I want to emphasize it, that we should not be just letting this go by and kind of feeling sorry for Charles and hoping that it all turns out all right for him, and not wanting to upset these people. I felt that way in the beginning because I felt a little responsible since he said those things on my program, and then they discovered him and then started writing all that. And when something that like that first comes out, it surprises you and it shocks you. And I know that it was rather shocking to Charles. Although when you think about all the things he's been doing all this time. And out in the open, that you wonder, you know, how it would, why it didn't happen sooner. But it was that business with the Holocaust. It was his actual words. I think the Holocaust is a myth, which was on my program. But I think now that this thing has gone on, it's got legs, and we need to use it, and we need to go back at these people, in whatever ways we can think of. Writing articles, I don't have time to do it. I didn't want to make it worse for Charles, but now I'm ready to do more about it. And I think it should be done. And write letters and attack these people for being disgusting, for being repulsive, for having morally repugnant views and misreading history and being narrowly didactic. And not understanding history at all, and not wanting to understand it, and all of the things that they are doing, and bringing up why is it wrong to question the Holocaust? That is a huge question right there. It's stupid to think it's wrong. And all of these things, we need. I think this one incident here with Charles Kraft opens a lot of opportunity for that in mainstream areas. In areas where a lot of people are paying attention or listening are interested in it. So that's why I talked about it some more. And I would like to say that to start, you know, I'm not nearly as far along as I thought I would be, as I expected to be in the second hour. So I'm going to try to move through this because I don't want to miss out on my dear friend Ken Walzer. But, you know, when we talk about these people who take the Holocaust as they call it, so seriously and accuse Nazis of horrific war crimes. They never mention the Allied war crimes. And, you know, Charles Kraft did on one of his plates, his disasterware plates, he did put an image of bombers over Dresden. And it says Dresden on it. And nobody objected to that because it's a known fact that that was done. Dwight David Eisenhower, who was a two-term president of the United States, was involved in that. And he is one of the biggest, well, I don't know how involved he was in that, actually. But anyway, the United States military was. But Dwight Eisenhower is one of the biggest war criminals who ever lived. And this is a fact. It's everything that he did that was criminal is known. And it's all on record. And yet he's revered around the world when all his crimes are known. So this, if you talk about something being a disgrace or being repugnant or whatever, this is one. And I think it should be talked about much, much more. And of course the crimes of Churchill are the same, but I'm just caring about Eisenhower right now. So first I want to look at Eisenhower's speech about the, and of course this came up a little bit on Saturday and got me going. I wanted to say more about it. So Eisenhower's speech about the military-industrial complex that people are saying was so great. Oh, he was so wonderful to warn us like that. Oh, you know, as though it was any skin off his back. But it was a standalone short speech, I do believe. I saw it on YouTube, and they started out saying, you know, and now, ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States, and he came on, and then at the end, you know, he was finished and it went black. So I think, I thought it was part of his farewell address to the nation, but I think now it's a standalone speech that he gave at some point towards the end there. And he was saying how the United States used to be a very simple country and full of farmers, and they had their plowshares and their plows, and they could make plows and they could make swords, but they didn't have there was no big armaments industry in the United States. He says, we now have a permanent armaments industry. Of course, this is now 1958 or 1959 or maybe 1960. And he says, something new in our history, this armaments. And now a part of the structure of our society. We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel a proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals, that security and liberty may prosper together. And that was it. And reading this now, how are we supposed to stop it? He says we must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties, our democratic processes. We were already endangered. Our democratic processes were probably already out of our control. And he was actually a product of Jewish power. He allowed Jews to help him get to where he got all the way along the line. And this is to me. Instead of being appraising him for this speech, I think he should be seen as a big hypocrite. And he was giving this speech, as I said before, to absolve himself. He knew what was going on, and he knew how it was going to go after he left office. And not because he left office, it was just going in that direction. And he thought he would take this opportunity to make out like he was a good guy warning us about it. And he was really just absolving himself, of any blame for what was to come. And of course, he was a part of the military. He knew everything about the military and the industrial. This guy, well, let's go on about him. We'll see what kind of a person he was. And a lot of you know, but it doesn't hurt to go over it. His family roots were, his family is supposedly German. Eisenhower is supposedly German for iron hewer, and they migrated from Karlsbrunn, Germany, to Switzerland in the 17th century due to religious persecution. So they were a family that was not one of the you know, big religions, either Protestant or Catholic. They had one of these sects. You know, they were people in one of these sects. They had to do it their way, and so they suffered from persecution. So they were looking for a place where they wouldn't. And they the Eisenhower family went to Pennsylvania in 1730. And in the 1880s, they moved to Kansas. So they were called Pennsylvania Dutch in Wikipedia. And whatever Pennsylvania Dutch is supposed to be, you know, Dutch is really a different version of Deutsch, which is German. And I know the whole thing about him being Jewish, and I cannot see that there's any strong backing for that. I don't know where there's any evidence that what is said happened, that he admitted he had some Jewish blood or something, that really ever happened. So I don't care. You know, it doesn't matter if he did or if he didn't. If he didn't, he still did what he did. He still got help from Jews and always seemed to be working for Jews and whoever could help him out. He went to West Point because he didn't have money for tuition. Well, there's nothing bad in any of this, but the article at Wiki is exceedingly complimentary, and it mostly comes from Stephen Ambrose, his official biographer. However, there's some things Ambrose said that are not so complimentary. And to just start out, that and when he was already in, you know, in World War II was already going on. It says some of the things he did was he argued with Roosevelt over an essential agreement with de Gaulle to use French resistance forces in covert and sabotage operations against the Germans in advance of Overlord. Overlord was the Normandy landing, you know, the D-Day thing, where they wanted to get, you know, land on the European continent. And this was a huge, huge operation, which he was in charge of. And anyway, Roosevelt, okay, I'm a little confused. I confused myself here. I'm ahead of myself. Okay, using the French, this is the first thing that he did. He wanted to use French resistance forces in sabotage operations against the Germans in advance of this landing. And this was illegal, you know, according to the Hague Conventions. And I think it's the Hague Conventions, not the Geneva Convention. And this was in Hague Conventions have been in place for quite a long time. So that was standard. But de Gaulle agreed with him that de Gaulle also wanted to use the French resistance. And I guess Roosevelt held back because it was illegal, you know, according to so-called this international law and so on, but he gave in, and that's what they did. Now, Eisenhower then designed a bombing plan in France to bomb France in advance of Overlord, another project to make it easier for the landing to succeed. And he argued this time with Churchill over Churchill's concern with civilian casualties. Because they knew that this bombing that Eisenhower wanted to do in France to soften up the area and you know, make things difficult for the Germans was going to kill a lot of French civilians, which it did. I suppose 1,000, or I didn't have time to actually look up the number, but I know that's been talked about a lot, and a lot of French citizens were died in all that bombing. Allied bombing that were, you know, just, they were supposed to be fighting for these people, but they were killing them while they were doing it. And, Churchill was concerned about that because, you know, there he was, the leader of Britain, and he didn't want the French to be accusing them, him, of being a part of this killing of French citizens, strong bombing campaign they were going to do there, like they did in Germany, although they weren't bombing people's houses. But again, de Gaulle interjected, and he just said it was justified. The leader of the French said these casualties were justified in his eyes in order to get the Germans out of his country because he wanted to get back there and rule it himself. And so Eisenhower prevailed in this, in killing all these French people. And then he also had to deal with George Patton, often reprimanding Patton because Patton was a kind of a wild card, but he was such a brilliant general, and that he needed him. So he was dealing with Patton a lot. Now, so when the Normandy landing, that there was all this coordination with the French resistance that we were talking about on Saturday, and the British Special Operations Executive orchestrated a massive campaign of sabotage, which the resistance was to carry out with their help, with the help of the special operations and the spy, the British, whatever. Here's what they did. They developed four plans for the French resistance to execute on D-Day and the following days. They had the Green Plan for a 15-day operation involving sabotage against the rail system. The Blue Plan dealt with destroying electrical facilities, and Tortue, I don't know, is that yellow, was a delaying operation aimed at the enemy forces that would potentially reinforce Axis forces at Normandy, delay the reinforcements. And the Violet Plan dealt with the cutting of underground telephone and teleprinter cables. So they were doing all this damage, which again was, here's what I want to say, this is against international law to utilize non-uniform civilians who are hiding themselves and not presenting themselves as military, as the enemy military, and doing all this damage to a military force in the field that has a right to be there. And they didn't have that right, but they, again, Eisenhower overruled this. He really wanted this, and de Gaulle went along with him. So in 1968, there was a counterinsurgency information analysis which detailed the results of the French resistance sabotage efforts. And it says that in the southeast, 52 locomotives were destroyed on 6th of June, and the railway line was cut in more than 500 places. The telephone on the 7th, the telephone network in the invasion area was put out of order. And beginning June 20th, the railway lines of France were rendered inoperable. Marked delays were achieved against the movement of strategic reserves. They delayed, the French claimed to have delayed up to 12 divisions for 8 to 15 days. So it was very effective. But again, they won through breaking the laws, which later they used against the Germans, even though the Germans hadn't actually broken these laws. They're the ones who did it. So this is just another aspect of the deceitfulness of this whole business. And of course, the D-Day Normandy landings on June 6, 1944 were successful, but they were costly. They were not only costly in the civilians in France, but they were costly to the American and British and Canadian soldiers who were doing the landing. And so let's go on that. In December 1944, he was promoted to General of the Army, equivalent to the rank of Field Marshal. And he had never seen action himself. I find this really amazing. This guy became the head person, like a field marshal, in European armies, the highest you can be. And he had never seen action. He had never assumed control or command over a group in the field, over a division or anything, even a regiment or even a little group in the field. He had never been in real military action. Never. And yet, he rose to this. And how these people, how he could have respect of others, I don't know, but they say he did. That's the military for you, I guess. And he was good friends with Marshal Zhukov, his Russian counterpart. They got along just real well. And he liked the Russians and he liked Stalin. So let's say here, 1 month before the end of World War II, Eisenhower then was thinking about the POWs, right? What to do with them. And it said that, he put out this special order concerning the treatment of German prisoners in specific language, which stated, quote, prison enclosures are to provide no shelter or other comforts, unquote. And his biographer, here's where Stephen Ambrose gets off the, just being so nice to Eisenhower in every way, and does say that he had access to Eisenhower's personal letters. And they showed that he proposed to exterminate the entire German general staff, which was made up of thousands of people after the war. He wanted his idea that he proposed to his equals there was to exterminate all the German general staff. I think that this is common knowledge too. And in his personal letters, he revealed that he didn't merely hate the Nazi regime and the few of them who were at the top, but he hated the German people as a race. And he spoke about that. Of course, we know that he said, wrote to Mamie, God, I hate the Germans. And I don't know if they're only referring to that or if there's more of what he said, because this was actually in Wikipedia. And that he was looking for a way to wipe out as many Germans as he could, and he couldn't exterminate the general staff because the other Allies wouldn't go along with it because it was illegal. Under international law. And now this is clear, it was illegal under international law. They couldn't do that. So what he came up with was to issue this order on March 10th, 1945, March 10th, verified by his initials on a cable of that date, that German prisoners of war be pre-designated as disarmed enemy forces. This was his brilliant idea. And he labeled it DEF for disarmed enemy forces. So now these were not prisoners of war who had lots of rights, how they had to be treated, but these were the enemy who is now disarmed, not taken prisoner. This doesn't even indicate that they were taken prisoner. It indicates that they're enemy forces and they've been disarmed. Well, these enemy forces, these Germans laid down their arms because they were told they had to surrender. And they surrendered under the natural idea that they were going to be prisoners of war and there were some rules as to how they're going to be treated. But Eisenhower pulled this trick and he got away with it. How he got away with it, I don't know. This is what's so disgraceful. And these people who are talking about Charles Kraft, this is the kind of thing they need to hear. Eisenhower ordered that these Germans did not fall under the Geneva rules, the Geneva Convention rules. They are not to be fed or given any water or medical attention. And the Swiss Red Cross was not to inspect the camps, for they had no authority or jurisdiction under this DEF classification. And he enforced this and he kept enforcing it, even though other people were kind of shocked by it and didn't like it, but he was the top dog, and months after the war was officially over, his DEF camps were still in operation. And what they did, they forced these men into confinement, but denied that they were prisoners. And yet there they were behind this barbed wire in these open fields, and these snipers set up around the perimeter to shoot if anybody did anything they weren't supposed to do. And says that George Patton turned his prisoners loose to fend for themselves and find their way home as best they could. Well, that was tough in itself, because that I know two who did that, and they have talked about it and written about it, and they faced all kinds of pitfalls, particularly the one, and barely got home. And, you know, because the one was in the eastern zone and had to, you know, could be picked up by the Soviets at any time. And they just went around picking people up and sending them to their gulags. That's what they were doing. They were doing that to civilians, too. Anyway, but this was better than what Eisenhower did. And when Eisenhower found out that Patton was letting his prisoners go, you know, I mean, they weren't really prisoners. He was just the war was over. These were just soldiers. They're supposed to be able to go home. But no, he was furious, and he issued a specific order to Patton to turn his men over to the DEF camps. Turn these men over to those horrible DEF camps where they were dying. You know, 1.7 million died. That's the general, and that's the low estimate. That's the minimum estimate that everybody will accept, except maybe, you know, these people, these Eisenhower apologists or whatever. But probably some of Patton's men did end up there. Probably a lot of them did, but a lot of them didn't. So anyway, in 1989, after the guy who wrote Crimes and Mercies and so on, Other Losses, did his work, I think it was after that, this Peter Worthington of the Ottawa Sun reported in a column that he wrote in the Ottawa Sun, quote, "It is hard to escape the conclusion that Dwight Eisenhower was a war criminal of epic proportions. His DEF policy killed more Germans in peace than were killed in the European theater." And he says, quoting some more, "For years we have blamed the 1.7 million missing German POWs on the Russians. Until now, no one dug too deeply, that is, into the problem. But now it's come out." And, you know, this is what he is. And he committed so many war crimes. Now there's still some more. I think, no, this is, that might be it. This is, about his, West Point time. I'm not gonna go into that. Oh yeah, well, the Morgenthau Plan. Okay, there's a little bit here. He was appointed military governor of the U.S. occupation. First he went back to the U.S., and then they sent him back as military governor of the U.S. occupation zone. And he had no, he had control only over the U.S. zone. But he, this is the same thing. Okay, along with reclassifying the prisoners of war as disarmed enemy forces, He followed the orders laid down by the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Before that was changed, you know, in the beginning that was the JCS 1067, was the Morgenthau Plan. And it explicitly prohibited U.S. occupation authorities from providing any economic or reconstruction assistance of any kind to the German people, not even to maintain the current economic levels. As you know, they were on starvation level. What do you call it? You know, the food that they gave them. And he, you know, in the beginning, when that was still in effect, that directive JCS 1067, says he followed that, you know, to the very strictly. Then the other thing he did, oh, shoot, still got more with him. Operation Keelhaul. This goes along with the JCS 1067 in a sense, but there was this This was the repatriation of over 2 million former Russian prisoners of war to Joseph Stalin, which was really an act of genocide, which they say that Adolf Hitler and the SS carried out. But actually, the Allies and General Dwight Eisenhower really did carry it out, and knowing exactly what they were doing, because it involved rounding up and shipping back to their countries of origin all the refugees from communism, men, women, and children, soldiers or civilian, male or female, even though many of them had been fighting on our side during the war. This is what Stalin demanded, and they thought they... And Eisenhower thought that, that it was the right thing to do, give Stalin what he wanted, because he thought Stalin was a real friend of theirs. And since all of Eastern Europe then became under communist domination, by sending these anti-communist people back, 2 million of them, approximately, or maybe 5 million. The minimum figure is 2 million. The maximum figure is 5 million. That's the minimum, not the 1.7 million German soldiers. That's probably, that's not a minimum. But this 2 million Russians is. And not just Russians, but all people from Eastern Europe. They all had to go back to their country of origin. So some of them were from, they'd be from Poland or Hungary or Romania or all these countries, Latvia, whatever, they're all under the control of the Soviet Union now. And so they were communists. And so when they were sent back, it was a death sentence. Some of them were immediately executed, and then the rest often died from overwork and malnutrition in the Soviet slave labor camps in Siberia. And they were rounded up at bayonet point and forced into freight cars and shipped off to a terrible fate. Now, is this not exactly what they accuse the National Socialist Government and Third Reich of doing? And this is what they did. And they did it all the way down the line, because they did it with Tito's forces, and they forced the white Russians that were down there in the Balkan states, along with the Austrians, and the British did it here. They forced these white Russians, they turned them over to Tito's forces, and Tito delivered them back to Stalin, or they took care of them themselves, but they were all killed. And they knew they were going to be killed, but they did it because they had agreed with Stalin, and they figured they couldn't have won the war without Stalin. So, all this took place, and Eisenhower was right in the middle of it. And he approved of it all. It says, I already said that. So, says that Eisenhower enforced this action, this Kiel Hall action, rigidly, even though it violated international law, the laws of his own country, and laws of humanity. And, of course, as I said, Germans were prosecuted at Nuremberg for similar crimes, whether true or not, but it was control of the news that ensured that Eisenhower and those under his command who took part in this criminal activity were never even officially accused of wrongdoing. So when he went back to Washington, Eisenhower was convinced in 1946 that the Soviet Union did not want war and that friendly relations could be maintained. I don't know how. I really don't know how, considering Stalin's policies. But Eisenhower strongly supported the new United Nations, and he favored its involvement in the control of atomic bombs. And he thought he was a peacemaker, And by mid-1947, he gave that up, and he agreed with the containment policy, and then the Cold War started. So, and he also was criticized for failing to defend George Marshall from attacks by Joseph McCarthy. Actually, Eisenhower, who privately denounced McCarthy, publicly campaigned with him for president in 1952. No, wait a minute. Well, he privately deplored McCarthy, but he wouldn't defend George Marshall from McCarthy's attacks. That was it. And he did campaign alongside McCarthy in 1952, and he refused to defend Marshall's policies. I guess he felt Marshall was a competitor of his, although Marshall didn't behave competitively at all and gave way to Eisenhower all along the line, but Eisenhower felt competitive because he's just a prick, you know, he's a real prick. And that's it with Eisenhower. So this man is definitely a war criminal. It's all there. It's more than with anybody else almost. It's all there in black and white. And why is it that none of that counts and that this man became president and everybody thinks he's Mr. Wonderful? You know, still, Ike, you know, the smiling Ike. And, you know, one thing I'll say about Eisenhower, I think he was a very mediocre mentality. He wasn't dumb or stupid or anything, but he was average. And he knew he was average, and he came from a competitive type family, you know, one of these large families with lots of kids and work ethic and all that, and he wanted to succeed. And he succeeded by brown nosing the right kind of people, and can't even go into that, but it's known that he was helped very much by Bernard Baruch. And then he was on very good terms with Morgenthau and you know, all those people. And he agreed with them, too, because he was a hateful kind of guy. And there we have it. So that's one example that can be used and should be used much more strongly. And now Ken Walzer, I'm so familiar with him, and I don't know. I'll just say that he is still head of the Jewish Studies Department at Michigan State University, and he has made a career. Well, he serves the Holocaust industry, I'll say that. And he's been, you know, he's another mediocre person who's just has you know, average mentality. He's gotten very fat. He's increasingly gained weight as he's gotten older. Now he's just kind of grossly obese, and his face is so fat, and it's just rather disgusting. But I have disliked him very much because he has been an advocate for Elie Wiesel and all these lies about Elie Wiesel at Buchenwald, because Ken Walzer made the study of the boys of Buchenwald his specialty. You know, that's his specialty. And he's done all this research. He's been able to go to Bad Arolsen Red Cross archives in Germany and do research, which ordinary people cannot do if you don't have the right credentials. And he says he finds all this stuff. And he used to have, he's been writing this book, which had a temporary title of The Boys of Buchenwald, but he's changed the title now. But he started writing this book, okay? You know, he had this website sponsored by the Michigan State University, which is where he's a professor. It was about 6 or 8 pages, and he had different stuff on different pages, and he had one whole page just for Elie Wiesel, and he mentioned Elie Wiesel a lot, and he was talked about how all this research he was doing in this book he was writing called The Boys of Buchenwald. And he would be coming out with it soon. He was always promising he was going to come out with it soon. Well, yeah, so I started writing about him and paying attention to him on Elie Wiesel Cons the World, you know, that website of mine. And I have quite a few articles, and I'm going to link to some of them in the program page because I'm referring to them here. But in one, I went through and found out his various statements, because he had all this stuff on that website. Well, I have to tell you that website was up for a long time, and when I looked for it yesterday or the day before, it's gone. And it's replaced. When you click on any of those links that used to go to those pages, you just go to this generic MSU page, Michigan State University page, and then you can find a page on him But it's just kind of another generic page. It's not this personal thing that he had going. So he's dropped all that. Well, the reason is he never has been able to finish that book. And that's because he had a lot of stuff he was saying in there about Elie Wiesel, you know, being one of these children at Buchenwald, one of the children that were taken care of in that special barracks by the communists that were there and so on, the communist prisoners. And you know, my contention is, and my thesis, I used Vincent Renoir's word, my thesis is that Elie Wiesel never was at Buchenwald. I am quite sure he never was at Buchenwald, and I doubt very much that he was at Auschwitz, although he may have been there for a while. But I don't believe he was at Buchenwald. And, of course, if for him to be one of these children in the children's barracks there and everything, he had to be there. So this was this thing between Kenneth Walzer and I, and I kind of went after Kenneth Walzer pretty aggressively. And, in fact, he then responded to me and got himself in deeper. So that was good. Anyway, the first it was mentioned was in May 2005, this book of his. 8 years ago, he presented a paper, The Rescue of Children at Buchenwald, and at a special colloquium, you know, at another at Wayne State University in Detroit. All right, that was the beginning of it. He started doing his research. Then in March 2007, 2 years later, 6 years ago, he made an announcement that he will present a paper on the Kovno boys, survival at Auschwitz, Buchenwald, and Mauthausen, at a Holocaust conference in Cleveland, Ohio. He doesn't miss any Holocaust conference or anything like that. He's at them all. And he's another person like Elie Wiesel who only really associates with Jews. I think he's only comfortable with Jews. He's extremely Jewish. Now, in 2007, 6 years, and again, 6 years ago, he presented his book in progress, The Rescue of Children and Youth in Buchenwald, at James Madison College. And then the following year, 5 years ago, the announcement says, MSU professor Ken Walzer gave a lecture at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum on the subject of his upcoming book on the rescue operations at Buchenwald that he said saved the lives of hundreds of children and youths. And in 2010, 3 years ago, his announcement was Kenneth Walzer, professor of history and director of the Jewish Studies program at Michigan State University, is currently completing a book about the rescue of children and youths at Buchenwald from the April 16th Jewish Daily Forward that was published in. And since then, nothing has been written about his book, and he was always promising his book on these web pages of his that have been taken down sometime in the past year. Because the last time I was about a year ago that I wrote about him, and they were there then. But since then, they're gone because he's not coming out with that book. He may yet, but he hasn't. And, it's too embarrassing. And all that stuff he had on there, he's having to revise, in my opinion. And a lot of it, most of it, is because of me. And I'm not saying that foolishly. It's because of what I've written and what I have said about him and what I have proven. And he had all this mishmash stuff, you know, unproven bits, just statements about Wiesel and so on that now he can't really use. And yet, he wrote a comment to me. I wrote an article on Elie Wiesel Cons the World saying that Walzer could not complete the book because of the exposures I was publishing about Elie Wiesel not being at Buchenwald. And Ken Walzer, showing that he reads that website, as I think they all do, he wrote a comment to that article that I wrote. And this was on June 27th. He wrote his comment, 2011. Carolyn Yeager suspects that Ken Walzer is having trouble with his Buchenwald book, especially proving Elie Wiesel was at Buchenwald, as he says he was. Nothing could be further from the truth. The Buchenwald book is drawn on survivors' experiences interviewed around the world and on documents from the Red Cross, ITS, and it will tell a powerful story of endurance and rescue inside Buchenwald. And related to that larger story in which Elie Wiesel is merely one of many boys who were helped and saved inside Buchenwald, there simply is no mystery whatsoever of Elie Wiesel, as Jaeger claims. He arrived from Buna on a terrible transport on January 26, 1945, with many others, including Miklos Gruner. And I stuck in here, you know, to let you know that's wrong. He did not. After more research that I did, and a lot of it with the help of Kletterdetch and his knowledge of Yiddish and so on, when we were going through the Yiddish book, we, you know, discovered a lot of things in all the various translations. And according to Wiesel's own figuring, he did not arrive at Buchenwald on January 26th. When that transport came, he screwed that up in his writing, because when he first wrote the book, didn't really matter to him. He didn't know anything, and he just wrote what he wanted, and then he had to follow that first Yiddish book. Either he wrote it or he was just using it, and so he followed it. Anyway, Walzer goes on to say, he was accompanied by his father, who was recorded as Abram, but who signed his name as Shlomo. Isn't that funny? His name is Abram, but he signs it as Shlomo. You know, in all the history of Jewish names, there is no connection between Shlomo, which is short for Solomon, and Abram, which is, you know, abbreviation of Abraham. But that's what he tries to say. He says they were initially together in a barrack in the little camp, barrack 59, I think, he says. And then after his father died, Elie Wiesel was moved in early February to block 66, the Kinder block. Miklos Gruner too was in block 66. Elie Wiesel was there with other boys from Siget who knew him. He was interviewed by military authorities after liberation. And that's, he says that, but that's wrong too, which I have demonstrated on that website, in order to permit departure from the camp. And he went after liberation early June 45 to France. He was in France, but I'm not sure when he went, how he got there. One among 425 boys who did so. He appears in subsequent pictures at Amblois and Tavernier Wellstone. More important, he says, gentlemen. All right. Good old Skype. Nope. Now it says there's a problem. All right, I'm back. I hope I stay back. So I was saying, I had a little Skype problem there. I was saying that that's what he wrote there. And I wrote on June 30th that I wasn't satisfied with Walzer's answer because it avoids the real questions in favor of repeating his claims without supporting them. And so this went on, and I don't have time now to go through all the things I've written about this, but the fact is that Kenneth Walzer, professor of history and Jewish studies at Michigan State University, has been stymied in his work with this book because of the work that I have done, and I firmly believe that, although he says he still has. This book is still going to come out, but it sure has taken a long time, and I'm sure it's quite different from what he was going to do in the beginning, and I'll bet he hardly mentions Elie Wiesel in it. Now, what he does show on his sites now is that this new film, there's a new film called Kinderblock 66, Return to Buchenwald. And he is the historical advisor for the film. That's the only thing he's got to show for himself in all these years that he's been supposedly, you know, working on this rescue of children from Buchenwald, that some other people, not him, made this film because there was, you know, the 65th or something anniversary of the liberation of Buchenwald some time ago. And they say here, the people who made the film, on April 11th, 2010, 65 years later, several of the surviving boys from Block 66 returned to Weimar and to Buchenwald. This is their story. So they had, you know, they either got hold of those people ahead of time or they got these, found these people there and they talked a few of them into being in this film. And I know, I want to say this before I run out of time, that they find the people for these films, just like Spielberg does for his Last Days film. They find the survivors who are willing to lie, because they've got only four survivors in this film. The four of them that they have is Naftali Furst, who I have a blog about. In fact, you can go to Elie Wiesel Cons the World, and on the recent posts on the left, the top left, it's still among those recent posts. It's called Naftali Furst claims to be in the famous Buchenwald photo as a 12-year-old boy. And he is one of the people in this film. And the others are Pavel Kohn, Israel Laszlo Lazar, and Alex Moskovic. And they're it's all very creepy. There's a trailer for it. And so if you go to www.kinderblock66thefilm.com. That's all one word, kinderblock66thefilm.com. You can see it there, or you can, it's also on YouTube. But it was only put up on YouTube March 13th, 2013, like 12 days ago. And it only had 21 views the last I looked. So I think only Jews are interested in this, and only Jews support it. But this, this film was made, let me get to, the writer and the director of the film is Rob Cohen. The executive producer is Stephen Moskovic. He must be the son of Alex Moskovic, who's one of the people that are one of the survivors, Alex Moskovic. And the executive producer is Stephen Moskovic. I'll bet you anything he is his son. And the producer is Brad Rothschild. Another producer is Paul Turlich. Another is Martin Pohl. And those are all Jewish names. And then the historian for the film is Kenneth Walzer. And it says, and then it asks you to donate. And you donate to the International Raoul Wallenberg Foundation. If you don't know, that's that thing, that Swedish guy who supposedly saved all these Hungarian Jews. The Swedish diplomat. And it says that they supposedly are the makers of this film. And it's one of their projects. And they're accepting tax-deductible contributions earmarked, for the production of this film. And they hope you'll make it a donation. And so this is all that that our dear friend Kenneth Walzer has been doing. All he has to show for himself is that this film has come out and he's managed to be the historical advisor for it. And then I want to mention a little bit here about Naftali Furst, who I wrote about and told you. And, Furst was at Buchenwald as a boy. He was 12 years old, and there's a picture on that post I made at Cons the World that shows him. He's a nice looking kid with blonde hair. And then there's another picture I have of him with his family 2 years after they got all back together again. Nobody in his family was harmed or died. But they were all in a camp. I didn't go into it until about 44, and it was a nicer family camp. And then eventually somehow they got separated. But he was with his brother at Buchenwald, this Naphtali, and didn't have a bad time, but he says he got sick. But then he had to say that he is in that photograph, that Buchenwald liberation photograph that Elie Wiesel claims to be in, the one with the naked standing man who is not really in it originally. And, you know, we've covered all of that. So why, I don't understand why this force wanted to lie about being in that photograph, because it's clear, I've proven that that's not him. It can't possibly be him. You have to look at that post to see it. But yet it says that he went around at the bottom of that post. There's a picture of him with Miklos Gruner and Hamburger. What's his first name that I've written about too? All three of them who are in that, who claim to be in that photograph. And the only one that really is in that photograph is Miklos Gruner. But they all lie together. And why they feel like they need to do that. But that's why I say that the people who they get for these movies that they make and tell their story and tell all this stuff that they say happened, they're all people who are willing to lie, like Irene Zisblatt, you know, the same thing. They get these are all liars. This is the kind of thing that, you know, we need to be informed about. I know it takes a lot of time to get informed, but you can't talk to these other people about how little they know. And this is not like to debate. This is not debating. This is about throwing this into their faces that what they are upholding ignorantly, the whole holohoax, but also these people who are the witnesses for it, like this Naphtali Furst, who claims he's in a photograph that he's not. And they're such liars that they just have to lie whether they need to lie or not, I guess. I don't really understand these people. But you just need to throw the facts about these people in the faces of these believers. And this is why I think we can't be nice and we can't think about how we're going to get along with all these people, because they're not people we want to get along with, nor could we ever get along with them. We're too different. We're too different. We don't think like they do, and we don't function like they do. And so that is all I've got time for. I hope you got something out of this. And as I said, I will be having guest hosts for the next 2 weeks. So I'm taking vacation every hour, and I hope you enjoy it. See you again. Bye.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.